We had, I always ranted that the presidential fitness test should be taken by the current president. And then Absolutely. Whatever their number is what the standard is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's not the title of office they're holding, really. It's like, what president has ever been fit, first of all? Why is that the standard that we chose? And if it is, I don't mind that. I'd love to see Bush do push-ups. And then, like, well, I was a presidential fitness guy from, you know, the Bush years. And then Obama got in and I didn't make it. Kind of.
Yeah, thing. Yeah. I feel like it's Jack and Barry. Those are the ones I can think of.
Although that Jimmy actually, probably. Yeah, that knew a gym existed. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Roosevelt's the other guy, too, who, like, boxed. Who just had, like, Daddy. That drunk strength. Yeah.
I know. Yeah. Hemingway before Hemingway. Yeah. The Welcome to the Sand Trap. Should I do it?
Yeah.
A podcast covering the filmography of Adam Sandler, the greatest comic of our generation. I think the first sentence was different, but I wrapped it in. I pulled it together.
Oh, I'm excited.
You don't say filmography, do you?
Oh, no. I would never. I couldn't handle that many types of sounds.
Yeah, we try to limit that, I know. Yeah, our first segment, Preston and by last time, is the mug shots. We have our mugs.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Mine rotating like a microwave. One day we won't be. But right now, we are all very young as hell. Mug.
It's such a... I love the punch at the end.
I like that. It's so thin. It has to go all the way around.
Did you do that intentionally? Was that...
It was the only way to fit it all in. I don't think I could make it two lines. It's a group me message from Jessie. Yeah. That I put on a mug and sent to her and got one for myself.
Mine's also Fred related. Not even knowing what you brought in. This is... I have instant coffee, which is almost like tea to me. So I grabbed this tea mug that I stole from a Chinese buffet that my friend Ian and I were at when we were visiting all the buffets in Chicago.
The buffet project.
Mm-hmm. The now buffet. Now it's a weird capsule into all the things that we'll never be able to do again.
Yeah.
Most of those places closed down, which is crazy.
It's kind of like visiting all the Rosie the Riveter factories before. But then the war ends.
Yeah, the Rosie the Riveter factories. Yeah, we're called riveters now. Buffets, yeah, because then everyone's like, you can't waste. It's too much waste in a buffet. All that food. So there's not many of them left. There already wasn't. And then the few that we went to.
They were the few to have sneeze guards, though. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
As far as like, yeah, they had that. They were ahead of the time.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Riveters knew, yeah. They made the sneeze guards. Yeah, they were like, keep your plastic. Make sure our boys overseas don't sneeze on each other.
I think our first segment is touching bases.
Yeah, touching bases. Yeah, we're going to touch some bases as we review.
Follow up on our through lines things.
On season two, yeah.
Yeah, which our biggest through line with Mr. Sandler, Adam, is man dresses as woman, funny. Which I promised to read more on Drag in the History of Film, which I did. I did read, but I haven't finished the book.
What book did you start off?
Simon Doonan recently published a book called Drag, The Complete History, which is complete, so I'm getting through it. I hope to get through it by Jack and Jill.
Yeah. How's it been so far? That sounds like a great book.
It's good, yeah. It's good, the introduction in the first chapter. But... We got 10 whole years till Jack.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. We have another season before we're even close to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's my style, the comprehensive. Yeah. But I had, read some like BFI things, and I made a Letterboxd list of the history of dragon film, which like main ones to cover, of course, are like Some Like It Hot, Billy Wilder's Some Like It Hot, and Psycho, which came out the next year, which like made this dichotomy of like comedy drag, which had been through Chaplin and the Marx Brothers Do It Too and Jerry Lewis. That's in the past. But then Hitchcock comes through and makes Psycho and makes the other half, which is like horror drag. And like all of a sudden you put a man in drag and it's scary. Give him a knife, you know? And it came at the same
disease, like a mental illness too.
Absolutely.
It attaches that stigma to it from then on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It came at like the same time that psychoanalysis and therapy became big. It was like 50s through 60s. And so, yeah, Psycho was 1960. And it has that ending, which is like the only thing that rings weird now these days, where the psychologist explains the whole thing. And and Man in Drag usually like is an underseated mommy issue. That was like the popular conception.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Really confusing. One of the few movies that, for as much of a classic it is, the framing, the tension, we know. Mm-hmm. But
yeah,
it explains an ending. Like, it explains what kind of movie do you ever watch? You're like, yeah, I'm so glad when the doctor came in.
True, yeah. And it even like, and you think of Vertigo, which explains, yeah, like nothing. And then, yeah.
Yeah, seriously.
Extends to Mulholland Drive and things. But yeah, that was Psycho was the first time you could see, because of the code, first time you saw toilet flushing on screen, of all things.
No, really?
Yeah. Wow. There wasn't even poop in it.
There we go. Breaking barriers for our boy. Our boy to fart happily, comfortably.
Hitchcock!
Exactly.
Yeah, that ending is weird. But yeah, it usually it became closely related to mommy issues, which is, you know, just not true. But later, Roman Polanski in 1976 made The Tenant, similar thing. You think of Buffalo Bill. There's no mommy thing there, but, you know, and that kind of like made the two paths, the comedy and the horror. But by the time John Waters, who we'll be digging into later, comes around, he and Divine kind of wrestle it back for actually kind of both. It's mainly comedy, but if you think about the bad taste and the true shocking nature of those films, it is a bit of horror too, I guess. I'm only just realizing. And yeah, Rocky Horror too. Rocky Horror. Yeah. Kind of melds the two.
It's subverting. It was embracing this aspect of snuff films,
which made me think, like, you know, I'm not about that remake culture, but, you know, in a similar vein, you think of, what if we could convince Samuel to adopt a Frankfurter? Like, he's already got this Dracula vein in him. He's got this Hubie thing. What if we got just that much? And he's got Jack and Jill. I would love him to play a Frankfurter.
That's so good. That'd be great casting. That'd be really great casting. I would. He would kill it in a camp remake of some musical, or like a new musical of some kind.
Yeah,
innkeeper or some. He would kill it.
Yeah, he would be a Frankfurter, and then like if Farley were still alive, he could be the Meatloaf. But Kevin James now, of course, would step in. I think.
Ugh, he can't hold a candle. He couldn't hold a candle. I know. I'm sorry.
I know, but he does kind of. He doesn't.
He has no opportunity to tap into that aspect of what we're talking about.
No, but you know, he's the king of Queens.
He is. His eyes are getting weary.
His harem.
Back is getting tight. I'm sitting here in traffic on the the Queensboro Bridge tonight.
Oh yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
I don't care, because all I want to do is cash my check and drive right home to you.
They ripped that whole thing from The Sopranos. You think of Kevin James, he's basically Gandolfini.
That is so great. You're right. Wow. When did that come out? Hold on. You're going to blow my mind.
I'm right. Sopranos was 2000, I'm pretty sure.
But when it came, the debut of Sopranos was 99. Mm-hmm. So
that famous year.
Yeah. King of Queens, the American sitcom. Started 98. Buddy,
we should have been following James along, because that's when Wedding Singer and Waterboy.
First season
must have been like right before Waterboy.
Oh man, somebody has some explaining to do.
Yeah, somebody called David Chase.
Yeah, David Chase.
That's the one, right? That's the David.
Get on our line.
There's Milk
yeah.
Chase and Simon.
Yeah, exactly. Mr. It's Chase, I know you're doing Talking Sopranos. Now it's time to come balls in our court, baby. Mm-hmm. Come to the other hallway of NYU.
Yeah. Come to Happy Madison Square Garden.
Yeah. Come. Yeah. We got some questions for you. What do you know about Kevin James? Where were you in 1998?
Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the 70s for that. And then in the 80s for drag, it ends up kind of Tootsie and Dustin Hoffman pull it into the mainstream, or like the Prestige Academy kind of thing. And then a year after that is Yentl, if we're talking about gender swap, 1983, where Barbara Streisand dresses as a man to study the Torah, and along the way, pretty much regardless of gender, drag, you know, is side by side with each other. But the 80s, it becomes prestige, and then the 90s, it kind of turns into like this threshold of what we start seeing, like accepted trans characters, or like even the terminology trans kind of coming in with the Birdcage and like Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, Tu Bong Fu, Thanks for Everything. A great one, I love Orlando, where Tilda Swinton, it's an adaptation of a Virginia Woolf novel, and like switches gender, or like it hits drag halfway through. It's very ethereal, interesting. And The Crying Game, if you know about like that famous twist.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which, like, yeah. If you think Sleepaway Camp has a similar one, but that's the 80s. That's early 80s. That's slasher trasher. And but that's the Waters Camp.
Mm-hmm. We were saying before how some of this 90s embracing of this archetype seems to be a little bit of that Xer, yeah, I'm doing it kind of edge. Mm-hmm, so it's still, I think that's also fueling some of these characters and things.
Absolutely.
Like that.
Which is how it can seem a little ahistorical, which is why when I look back, it's like, oh yeah, of course I knew that drag was a part of a comedy from all the way back to the early beginnings of film. But it does feel a little ahistorical because of the, frat bro nature and the burgeoning technology of videotape. And they don't seem to be referencing necessarily any of those, but.
And it's true that, and then Paris is Burning wasn't really even brought up in the conversation.
I have that
forever
on here,
right?
That's like, 1990, I believe.
That's depicting stuff even before then, covering all that stuff. So it's
So in the 90s, it starts melding into, you have the Priscillas and the Tu Bong Fus, and then it is with the Sandler movies and the more comedy. Things like that. And then in the 2000s, it ends up being dominated by Tyler Perry's Madea and like White Chicks and things.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
All this. Yeah. 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 So that's, I put every Madea on here, which I unfortunately have not seen any of them.
You haven't?
Have you?
Which one have I seen? I might have seen Madea Goes to Jail.
Let's see. I have these in order. It's a Diary of a Mad Black Woman, Madea's Family Reunion, Meet the Browns, Madea Goes to Jail, I Can Do Bad All by Myself, Madea's Big Happy Family, Madea's Witness Protection, Madea Christmas, Boo a Madea Halloween, which is what I would want to start with, Boo 2, which is their Hubie.
Yeah, seriously.
A Madea Family Funeral, which I didn't know came out in 2019.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then late, you know, as the internet comes in and film becomes divided into subgenres and atomized into like what even is. What could we call anything unless we're 20 years out? You get things like Tangerine, Sean Baker's Tangerine, where like trans actors are actually playing trans characters alongside like Eddie Redmayne being like getting an Oscar nomination for Danish Girl. It's like those two halves of things, you know, and identity politics come into play. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's my history. You can check the letterbox list. Everyone will. I'll have to turn my phone off, I'm sure.
Just all the calls
and Venmos.
Yeah, a lot of Venmos for the letterbox. Yeah, letterbox lists are a big moneymaker. That's true.
Yeah. What can I say? I don't want to do it, but I have to.
You know, I'm just thinking of what was that documentary, that Netflix one that was basically like the new Jim Crow documentary? 13 or whatever?
Oh, yeah, the 13th. The Ava DuVernay one? Yeah.
Yeah. 13th. I was just thinking. That's the double feature. It's that, and then Madea Goes to Jail.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. Because that one would have come out. Yeah. Probably lined up. That was 2016.
Yeah.
That's probably around. That's close. Booze. That's booze year.
That's so good. Yeah. It's one of those things. Maybe that's another one we could do. I would be pretty interested in doing that as a mini series of watching all the Madeas.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like Norbit-esque.
He refuses to let that character go despite all of the criticisms. It's very interesting to me.
He might have to be our next dive in because is that box office driven? Obviously it's a huge box office run, but
it's
because
really interesting.
His Madea movies are the ones that make, I don't know.
He's right up there. He's reckoning with a lot of the same stuff we're interested with Sandler for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And then I almost forgot, I have to mention, internationally, we have Pedro Almodovar. Almodovar? Yeah, he's often has drag and trans characters in his movies, like Law of Desire and High Heels and Bad Education. Those are great Spanish movies.
Hmm.
So, yeah, we like that. We like that international stage. He's often, it's almost like every film ends up being about that kind of thing.
So, in lieu of more text and theory and thought, since we're still cooking through those things, we've got a little bit of a list, setting it up.
Mm-hmm. It just takes...
By the time you watch these, watch this list, generate some ideas about it in your head, mm-hmm. and by the time you're getting through the list, we'll be catching up right around Jack and Jill, I bet.
Yeah, we'll have the literature down. It's just hard. I can't read a book and watch a Sandler movie at the same time. I have probably tried, but...
can't be done.
Know, we have to split.
Cannot be done. Yeah, but... Yeah, you have to send me that one, too. You have to send me that one to read. That sounds like a good one.
Yeah, yeah. We can both do it. I only found it recently, in the past week or so. But, which is why I couldn't fit it in here. And that segues nicely into John Waters' Boy, which is the through line of this season, which is that Adam Sandler makes Freddy John Waters movies, which is just a John Waters movie, if you were to encapsulate it, is just an exercise in bad taste. That is literally the tagline of Pink Flamingos, his like mm-hmm. second. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Let me see if I can briefly run down. You know, it'll be quick. But he has like Mondo Trashos, his first. He's a Baltimore filmmaker, as we've said in past and he's an openly gay filmmaker. He's into camp and filth and trash. And he starts with Mondo Trasho in 1969. Then we got Multiple Maniacs, Pink Flamingos, Female Trouble, Desperate Living, and then Polyester in 1981, he kind of gets mainstream. Hairspray is his biggest hit, remade with John Travolta, as we know. Crybaby has Johnny Depp in 1990. Serial Mom, and then these are his late movies. Pecker, 98. Cecil B. DeMented, which has Patricia Arquette of... Nope, God, sorry. That's Melanie Griffith. She just looks like her in that photo. But I know Melanie, right? Oh my God, Maggie Gyllenhaal's in that. And Michael Shannon. I haven't seen Cecil B. yet.
I haven't either. That sounds bonkers, though.
We should watch that. Okay, yeah. And then, yeah, I think it's the bad taste that is the through line. It all hinges on Waterboy, which is why we had the John Waters Boy then. It ends up being his... It feels the most like Pink Flamingos, and it feels the most like purposely bad taste, classist and racist and sexist tales. And other than 8 Crazy Nights, which is his second closest, because the poop goes through the deer's teeth,
and that does break divides. Animation records mm-hmm, of mm-hmm. of the offensiveness.
You almost think, what if John Waters tried like an animation? It would look a little like that.
It would look very much like that, and that's what mm-hmm. we talked about with that. We went into that last week, earlier this week.
Mm-hmm.
That
Sandler,
we're surprised he didn't do more adult animation.
Yeah.
Because it seems like a better avenue for some of the stuff he likes to do. But I think the experience was just more difficult than he expected. But it is interesting. And that's a good point, too. Like, what if Waters animated a movie? I could see it looking very similar to, like, how Sandler envisioned a small town in nowhere America is... making those caricatures is really close to what John Waters would probably look.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at. The New Orleans or the Louisiana style. Yeah, kind of is similar to that Baltimore crew. And it made me think that like the difference, and it almost makes Sandler's movies more grotesque, is that he insists or he makes them PG-13 because they're family movies. Like the fact that it's the Waters are the hard R. They're like, you see asshole, you see like everything. It's like disgusting, but it's like that you almost like you do expect, you're like at the limits of filth, and like where Sandler can has this, because it has a wall, a boundary that he's unwilling to transgress, which is the R rating, it ends up almost being more jarring for me personally. And like I wonder if, from what I've heard and read from people, if I can't glean that, I think it is like, it's like these veering tones, the things I talked about in Little Nicky and Big Daddy, which is a family film, and then you got the pukes and the, you know, the swerves, you know, which is the things that Ebert can't vibe with. Yeah. The ambivalence, as you called it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. In that he recognizes that in Waterboy too. He says, mm-hmm. if you're gonna go there, make it antebellum, make it out of this world. But that's a similar thing. You're right. So it's bubbling up, and it never really pops, though. We never see this. Mm-mm. But we see a lot of these examples come through that are attached to some of his more successful ones or interesting ones that are not the Billy Madisons or the Gilmores, which you actually wanted to get into. Since this season was bigger than last, we're trying to do a run-through of if there's anything else we picked up on or if we wanted to touch on.
Yeah, I'll touch that. I remembered Little Nicky being an under one. There was a character we missed, bringing it back to drag and man just as
that's
woman.
Right. Yeah.
Like, and that actually, this character we missed ended up being a point that like differs between Waters and Divine and Sandler's drag characters. But yeah, in Little Nicky, we forgot that as he was climbing up the New York fire escapes and they were playing Everlong, which is one of our love songs from Foo Fighters.
The Foo Fighters. He's right around the corner, man. Back. He's coming up, too.
Mm-hmm. Which, as you know from last season wrap-up, he's Matt Grohl. Yeah.
It's true.
And, yeah, so he's going to get Valerie Varin and meet Patricia Arquette's character, but he steps at the wrong window, which is where Clint Howard is dressed and pouring wax over himself.
Oh. Hello. That dude looks like a lady. You want to come in?
Actually, I'm looking for a girl named Valerie.
Valerie Varin? Two floors up, one window open.
Thanks much. Good luck with the nipple rubbing.
I don't need luck. I'm good.
I can see that.
His character's name is Nipples. Is he?
How we I think because we were had a different theme in mind for that episode, we just didn't.
I'm sure I had it highlighted in my notes, and I was like,
it's impossible to avoid. It's,
don't bring it up.
Yeah, it's similar to what you're saying, though. It's such an important role to point out because that's the first time we're seeing somebody who, presumably we can say, trans or playing with this idea.
Yeah, it gets more.
Man dresses
gets
as
more
woman.
Than a punchline.
Man dresses as woman, comma funny.
Yeah,
and it's almost like capital F. This is dehumanizing now. Before it never really felt that way, and it was almost a dig at some masculinity traits, or it would be mistaken identity stuff that you see a lot with this kind of topic. It's just a joke, and it's so limiting. Mm-hmm. It makes it so limiting and really takes you out of the movie.
Yeah.
And that's Waters would never do that. Waters would actually parody that feeling and make it the whole movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got to the point that I thought, which is like the Nipples' portrayal in Little Nicky ends up being like an extension of the Big Daddy gay lawyer stuff, which is like Sandler, as opposed to his earlier where drag jokes where he just kind of laughs at them as if they are monstrous or a little freakish, and ends up being he's situating himself as like a goalie from Gen X frat culture and being like, and his passivity and ambivalence is like, he's like, okay, you know, like it cuts back to him and Little Nicky and he's like, all right, where's Valerie's window?
Yeah, that's the other thing too. A lot of these other characters we've seen would have another aspect of themselves that might just extend the plot or gave them a little bit more to do.
This is
the first time where you're creating a circumstance for him to to come across this person.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, well, let's just make him. What if we just made him a guy who's into pouring wax on himself and dressing not like we dress?
Yeah.
And then they're like, yeah, that could hold up. And that they'll continue to do that.
Which
we'll get into toward the end of our next season, Rage Over Me. In his political era. We'll get more into his politics or lack thereof publicly and what we think that means or what that kind of says. And this is the start of it.
Which did we run into recently? I'm worried it might be the Rage Over Me one, but where Covert played the lawyer in Big Daddy, and then there was a recent one where Sandler had a gay lawyer. Was that Anger Management? It almost felt like a reference back to the Sandiverse of, I think, in anger management, because that's where he goes to court.
He does. Yeah, and he's like, has a lawyer, yeah, but I don't he know. Has Nealon, a lawyer. Oh, you're right. Nealon is gay in it. Yeah, and it's, I was going to say, we don't mention it.
It would be that one. Yeah, no, but we might.
We
as
don't
well.
Mention it in the episode, I don't think,
because I probably won't remember by the time we hit season three. But yeah, I did notice that it's the interweaving of the Sandiverse.
Yeah, you're right. And that's another thing that's a throwaway joke, quote unquote, where it's really, and that's the thing. That's why we didn't pick up on it.
Yeah.
Because he's just looking at a picture of his husband lovingly, and you're like, okay.
Mm-hmm.
But they were meaning for that to play like, oh, what? They're not going to talk about this? Yeah.
There was a, I think one of his lines is, why would I care? My lawyer's gay.
Yeah, you're right. I think so. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And then, which brings into, because if you're going through the movies, Big Daddy being a huge hinge, because Big Daddy's like a big turning point as the highest grosser, but also that is when it gets a little cleaner, or like the cinematography looks more naturalistic, and it starts that him being the goalie and being like, that's okay, a goalie of, you know, progressive in politics. And the one right before is Waterboy, which I think is the true like squeeze point of his early and late grandeur years. But if we start with Billy Madison, 1995, which was our first episode of the season, which is Tamara Davis laying the foundation. She doesn't come back into the stable, but she lets Adam into the editing room, starts a precedent. You know, you wonder if that didn't happen, what would have happened?
Yeah, if Tamara wasn't even there. Not even if she didn't let him in the editing room, but if she didn't direct him like that, what the legacy of that movie would be. I don't know.
She knows his angles, makes him hot, gives him a confident, like, supportive set to joke through, and lets him in the
reworks the love interest to not be so sexualized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that too. Yeah, all things
smooths over a lot of issues that would have limited him.
Yeah,
earlier.
Maybe hobbled him. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And because she kind of had like this, it was a step in job, maybe even a added to that, because she was on her feet most of the time, just having adapt
You're
to
right.
them, even though they were the first time stars. It was, they were both adapting to each other. It might even be that, like, lucky circumstance that kind of brought the whole Sandlerverse together.
yeah.
It's like a meet cute.
yeah. And then to follow up with Happy Gilmore,
which is, that ends up being the dichotomy. I feel like you're happy person or you're Billy person, which, you know, many people love both, but you know, you might favor one way, like left or right side of the ship.
Yeah, you love the binary. You always tell me.
I am
like, there's only
person,
two
yeah.
ways anything can
there's
ever
two
be.
Two things of anything. You could back out maybe, and there's two of those. If you back out, or maybe zoom in more.
But that's a new two
over here. There's So there are many,
but it's always two.
Can't hold more than two. I'm a happy person, as in a Happy Gilmore one.
Yeah,
as we went over.
Mm-hmm. And I'm a Billy Boy.
Yeah, Billy Boy. Happy person than Billy Boy. But yeah, that's when Dugan comes in first with the staple, the salesman, as we see.
Yeah,
as those come in. And then Wedding Singer is kind of like the synthesis of the dialectic. It's like, and he's growing in gross these whole times. And that's him establishing him as a rom-com person, truly, like I feel like. And then the fact that he follows it up with Waterboy in the same year ends up cementing it, which is like, I think, a very astute thing for artists to do as far as like keep in your memory. I don't say that it was like Machiavellian or like so, you know, calculated, but I think the luck was on the side, just in social, like the way we are social beings. It's like his two debuts, people are like recognizing him, you know, maybe you didn't see Billy, maybe you didn't see Happy, you saw Wedding Singer, maybe you didn't see all three, but then you're like, wow, this is like four movies. The fact that you would hook someone with one of those three and then you follow up with your four, you know, that same year. I don't think it was on purpose, but it ends up hooking. It's what artists tend to do, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That really hit.
That timing aspect of it is a very real thing.
And
movies.
It's like a blossoming of creativity, because you don't, your nerves are gone. You're establishing yourself as like, you've got three movies under your belt and you're just like firing, you know, you're in the door. Gatekeeper's gone. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it's that a little bit.
Yeah. And also the surprise success of Waterboy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
is truly. Why it's such a big turning point.
They might,
He didn't change. He didn't go into that thinking, oh, and this one will be the $80 million movie I make.
Mm-mm.
He was surprised that it turned into something so big. So looking back, that is the hinge point.
Yeah, we've talked about Karachi following, because he directed both in that year, Wedding Singer and Waterboy. And yeah, it seems like it might be like a throw off, you know, like didn't want it to lose money, obviously, but you know, ended up,
yeah,
you know,
no,
you're
it
doing
doesn't...
two movies in a year. And yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's got for all the disciples of his earlier stuff. My San Pellegrino. For all the people who are disciples of his earlier stuff. Waterboy. There are their fans. I like that movie. Mm-hmm. But it's misunderstood of how big of a deal that was, because it got him in the door at Sony.
Yeah.
As well.
From small sample size personal polls, I think, like, people who wouldn't necessarily say they hate Adam Sandler but wouldn't necessarily call them a fan, it's like that one is a low point for them, you know. Or like, you know, it ends up, because it is very, it really digs into the John Waters filthiness of Sandler sensibility, like, you know. Yeah, it's filth cinema, baby. Mm-hmm. Which is its most interesting aspect to me. Yeah,
yeah,
because that's when that's when he becomes a normal character or a good character, as we talked about, and the rest of the world is surrounding him is weird.
Is sillier. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And which links back to why we find A Crazy Night so interesting, because he had to depict that whole world as well.
Yeah. And
his characters are not as interesting as his worldview, which we never really see.
Mm-hmm.
Because like you said, he's a goalie. He's allowing what snippets will he allow in?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We don't often get to see him. And that's the funny thing though. He has complete control. He writes it. He has an idea of what he wants. We've seen that.
All his friends are there. He certainly lets them go hog wild with whatever they want, but he brings them in because he trusts their sensibility and, you know, he likes his friends around.
But it's hinged on those jokes. Mm-hmm. It's like and maybe that's why he's a remake king. Because when he has something to go off of, he can make it his own in a successful way, because it's so, would they know what they're trying to hit?
Yeah. 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 Deeds, actually, I thought just now was like very goalie quality. As far as he's, one knock against it is like he's almost lazy in that movie, or like seems so passive, but it is like him doing, you know, he's seeding the jokes to Winona and everybody, you know, he's being the Boy Scout on and off set. And yeah, I just picture, it's just the one I posted where he's talking by the fountain with Winona, and he is very, that's goalie acting, it seems. He's like, yeah, Boo Radley. You know, it's the straight guy. He's bouncing. You bounce off him.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's the Sandlerverse is a good term, because he is the center of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it revolves around him, and that is almost a weakness.
Mm-hmm. I know.
That intentional volleying to what they think, and like we said, hinging on jokes and trying to make sure that these things land diminishes other parts of what having almost complete control over the movie could do.
Yeah.
It
speaks to like the critical tiring, which is like they want something new, and it's like what I get excited by, which is like when he's alongside Jack Nicholson or Harvey Keitel shows up, or, you know, someone new comes in, or and Turturro, you know, the new stables, which he does end up doing regularly, but it ends up being kind of like a retrospect versus present, you know, divide, where it's like he is making movies over, you have to put yourself in the shoes of like, it's been a year, it's been 2 years, it's been, you know, and then another year. And it's like people want Adam Sandler, they're like, I'll go back to the theater. It's been a whole year. That was last June. Oh my God, I was dating Melissa.
Yeah.
Or like,
yeah,
yeah. You know, you live a whole life. And then, but, and it's only in retrospect that you're like, yeah, these are all the same.
So now it's time for our other segment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good cap for it.
Mr. Reed's.
Yeah, Mr. Reed's.
Mr. Reed's Hubie Decimal System.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let me try that. I slurred. It's getting a little late. This instant coffee didn't do anything.
It's because it's a flash, baby. You got to get that extended release.
Yeah. Need to get the Colombian coffee crystals. The Mr. Reed's Hubie Decimal System.
Mm-hmm.
There we go.
Mm-hmm.
Book recommendations, like we did last time. We have two. This is a heavy season on the literature, though.
Yeah.
Which ones did we already in the season? We had The Big Picture.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, almost three, because we read The Big Picture together, Ben Fritz.
That
was in our Happy Madison episode.
Happy Madison. That was the one that we based an episode on.
And laid the foundation of his Sony years. It's going to be a lot of rage over me. Yeah. And then I read the Paul Thomas Anderson Masterworks book, which is right here. Yeah, baby, it's big.
Very nice.
There's a whole section on, what do you know, inherent bias. I pulled it because it's dog ear. There's also Punch for Glove in there.
We each have a book this time around, and they kind of cross over into the themes that we talked about in one way or another. Mine's shock value. John Waters, almost a autobiography mixed with a manifesto. Of
was released in like 81.
Right? 81. This is one of the original, first print, whatever.
Oh, that rules. That's the first edition?
I think it is. It's an earlier edition. Cool. I think so. That's why it's got this design. I don't think they reprinted that much, so I think you can only get it in earlier editions.
I love that.
And there's a part that I decided to highlight. I've read snippets. I've not read all of it, admittedly. But
Lemony snippets.
I've read lemony snippets of it. One film that influenced me more than any other is the Visit Our Concession Stand ad that drive-ins invariably show between features. The production value on this standard short featuring the all-American family happily munching monstrous meatball sandwiches, overpriced tubs of popcorn, and disgusting warmed-up hamburgers varies from city to city. But you can always count on a certain ridiculous cheapness in the look of the film, no matter where you are. All my life I've tried to capture that magnificent sleaziness in my own productions, but always feel I've come up short when I compare my work to other Eat Our Meatball Sub ads. Now, he mentions two directors that he thinks are very important. He says exploitation films are the only ones that come close to the dreaded word art. He's shocked that film students babble on about Orson Welles or Howard Hawks when they ignore the two greatest masters in film history, Russ Meyer and Herschel Gordon Lewis. Both are snuff filmmakers. So if you're looking for some deep connective tissue on John Waters' influence, which we believe influences a lot of Xers, Sandler included, those two gentlemen are some people to look up.
Is it snuff film? Would it be? What is it? We're like
exploitation. Sorry. I use those interchangeably. I should. They're kind of different.
One's a subgenre. I understand why you... I just wanted to make sure.
One he mentions at length, the Russ Meyer picture, The Tenth, his tenth, he thinks is his masterpiece. Faster, Pussycat, kill, kill.
Yeah, that's one.
He believes it's a work of high art.
Russ Meyer did Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, which is a connection to Roger Ebert, because he wrote
Roger Ebert. That's right. That's right. I forgot to connect. That's the other connective tissue.
One of Waters' favorite movies.
Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, which is a picture, a movie that Roger Ebert wrote.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Is one of John Waters' favorite movies, and which it's a disaster of a movie. It was everyone hated it. It was a bad movie. We know why Roger Ebert reviews, but
it may be why
John Waters loved it.
You know, against or like doesn't vibe with Sandler so much as like he was in that filth world and he wants him to go further. We've heard him say it. Yeah,
it's true. Yeah, it's so funny for how effacing and dorky he seems. Yeah, he's a little freak. He's a little freak. Our guy's a freak.
And Siskel's a square.
Well, you think Siskel's a square, and then he's a Playboy freak.
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
he's a boat freak.
Yeah, I love boat. Yeah, he's Dan. He's Steely. Dan, Steely, obviously. Doobie.
Yeah, he's Dan Doobies. Yeah, exactly. He's got a fucking great set of hi-fi.
Eat pre-ordered Gaucho.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah, exactly. He knew the horn player on Gaucho. Yeah.
Yeah. I read Valley of the Dolls about 2 years ago. But I haven't seen the movies.
I think I might have seen a double feature or something, like some late night thing.
Yeah, maybe we'll have to do something that for some
I would love movies. To.
But, oh, man. Yeah, I lost it. Oh, the meatball subs. I've never been to a drive-in or a movie theater that served meatball subs. That sounds awesome. Have you?
A meatball sub inside? My friends and I have always thought that the... I think hand food is really rude. I think it's one of the funniest things really you'd have rude. A character eating.
Yeah.
In a movie, like an apple, I think is one of the rudest fruits.
Interesting. That's so rude fruit, too. You're a poet tonight. And food rudest.
So I always thought the funniest thing, because we always were like, what's the funniest thing you could bring into a movie theater to eat, to sneak. And it's ribs. The answer is ribs.
Ribs, baby.
Because it creates such a huge mess that they know had to have come from outside.
Yeah.
And you have to eat with your hands.
My high
so school... a meatball sub is right there, too. But without the bones, of course. My but just school... loose meat is crazy to eat.
Poet. Root fruit, loose meat, crazy to eat.
I'm sorry.
My high school girlfriend smuggled lo mein into a movie theater and after one of our dates, and it spilled all over her purse. And
that just, see, that's okay. That's like, nice.
It was just like I could smell it. We could smell it. We were like, "What? That's the lo mein." It's oh my god.
Did you also look around? Did you do this? Like, hey, do you guys smell lo mein? Yeah.
And then there's other things like, it's like one of my friends successfully like brought a cake in. You know, it's just like it's a gamble.
Oh, a cake! And what are they gonna do? Honestly, what are they gonna do?
I know. And if they talk to us, I would leave. I mean, I don't want to make them mad. It's just like, you know, I'm not harming anyone, and I'm not gonna chomp it like a fucking. That's the problem. It's
no. Your lo mein and cake ones sound like they could be in an episode of New Girl. Those are like nice. Those are nice and charming and sweet.
Yeah, Jeff Lehman is a New Girl. I've heard it. It's terrible.
Oh, you have?
I'd rather be, you know. What about Twin Peaks?
Oh my gosh.
Can I?
It's a compliment.
Season 3?
Come on. Season 3. That's great. Yeah, yeah. I never connected that with you, but that's But the thing is, it's not like you are that.
No.
But
no.
You could be in that show.
It slips in, yeah.
That's what I mean. It's not that, like, you're an episode. It's like, no, your quality
and I think
is
it's more
the
that
level
could,
of a written reality.
Yeah. It's more I could maybe be on an episode of, like, Raising Hope or Traffic Light, but, you know, those are just, like, lesser-known shows.
Raising Hope.
Raising Hope, I
think,
is one of the most undersung. I love that show.
Damn. Didn't expect to hear that one either.
It's a good one. Cloris Leachman. She'll come up.
She's coming up quick. Oh, yeah. And yeah, you didn't bring in a book, did you?
I read this William Goldman, who wrote The Princess Bride and a bunch of other actually bigger movies. I think Butch Cassidy and plenty of
also
other.
Named The Big Picture. Really funny.
Yeah, I know. But it's subtitled Who Killed Hollywood? And other essays. Mm-hmm. It's like a compiled his work for like Variety and things, you know, compiled essays. And it's a lot of Oscar coverage from 92 through 99. I just flipped through and like read it just to see if he mentioned any Sandler, but it's mainly things like Gump and, you know, prestige things he did. The only things he comes close to are like Cruise and things. It was an interesting read, but I basically went to my independent bookstore and was like, I pulled the thin film section. I was like, anything that was on the 90s. I tried to see what we could get, but
I just loved Gump got me for some reason. You said it. I loved it. It's all Gump.
Gump. I think that's a Weird Al song. It's a parodying Lump by the Presidents of the
Don't worry about him. That's America. Just Cousin Gump.
It's Gump.
Yeah.
I mean, like, he has multiple. The whole middle part of this book is railing on Gump. And then, like, after the railing on Gump, the end will be like.
Good for him, man.
The following were Academy Award winners for 1994. Best actor, Tom Hanks, Forrest Gump. Best director, Robert Zemeckis, Forrest Gump.
Oh, so he railed. So he uses that as like a. Yeah, exactly. Doesn't matter how much I've proven them wrong. Thought I was being mean. Looks like they swept that year.
Gump. That came up. What was our superimposed? Oh, it was Little Nicky. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Gump stumped me. But for my. Yeah. Yeah, I don't. That's the most I have to say about the book club. And I said a lot about the Paul Thomas Anderson on that episode.
Yeah.
I honestly don't want to get into it because I would go, don't open that door. But
our library is growing, though. Yeah. We'll have a nice, cute library. We'll have to, at some point, maybe one of the wrap-ups will have to be in person. We'll stage it. It'll be really nice. It'll be in studio.
Oh, yeah. At a buffet.
We can make it really cool. That would be, now you're talking. Now you're going to make me go off.
The Ryans.
That would be great. I think that'd be a good move. And then we could have a little bit of a library.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. My last one is, I have some numbers, the numbers guy.
You have a not a correction, but a clarification on the numbers.
Yeah, part of my corrections is because I've been using the -numbers.com because Box Office Mojo moved from independent to being bought by IMDb and Amazon. So like you have to have a pro account. We've heard it before. And I don't. I haven't gone into it. But you can't see like the week to week thing. So the numbers stepped in. But I've been reading it wrong. I thought that the numbers, I thought that the numbers on the numbers.com that I'd been reading are the weeks that that movie had been out, but it turns out that was the previous position of that movie. So like Mr. Deeds, for example, I said like Minority Report had been out for 1 week and it was because it had the number one, but it turns out it was because it was number one last week and it had been out for 2 weeks, which is the same thing. But you have things like My Big Fat Greek Wedding, which I thought was out for 14 weeks, but it turns out it was number 14 before. It's now number 13. It's been out for 11 weeks. It's all intricate stuff, but you know, My Enemies, we've talked about it.
The two-week delay.
Yeah, they all end up being about the same.
But it's just the specifics of the timing is mm-hmm. a little off.
Yeah, exactly. I was just reading the wrong number. So everything I said when I was talking about how many weeks it had been out is incorrect. Even if it is correct, it's an accident. And thank you. But I'll be going forward. It'll be better than that. And, you know, you just have to own up to your stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I learned, I guess I've listened to every Harmontown.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Yeah. There's something to be said. We're still trying to figure out, the pod is always ever changing.
Mm-hmm.
And each time we're trying something different.
I have to film New Girl.
You're always on set. You got a reunion coming up. They used to the Friends one.
Yeah,
you're next.
No. Did you watch that one?
No, I didn't. I saw the memes per usual. I'm not a Friends
actor. I didn't watch Friends. I watched the reunion because it sounded terrible.
Yeah, I like the drama. Of course. I love all the drama and stuff, but I was I did not watch.
My
sister was huge into that show.
We might have to watch it for Just Go With It. But it's because I'm a Courtney Cox head. Being a Scream fan, I think. That,
you know. Did you? We and, talked like, about Cougar that, Town, right? You like Cougar Town, don't
yeah,
you?
Cougar Town's
good. Here we go. I feel like I can think of
that's a good idea.